Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about the crucial political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the challenges facing everyone.
Good morning, folks. Mike Cosentino here, and we're on Democratic Perspective, another live performance of our progressive radio show. We got Gary LeMaster sitting over here trying to keep me from screwing up too bad.
And, good morning, everyone.
Yeah. And we have a guest. We have a very, very interesting guest, Aleth Rothschild. Good morning.
Good morning.
She's back in the Boston area, and we're on the phone with her. Alice is, I'm going to read her bio, at least some of it. She's an author and a filmmaker and OBGYN, doctor, and in all of that, she has spent a lot of time in the Middle East. So we're going to talk about the unending conversation, which hopefully someday will have a happy ending, and that's the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, among other things. As I said, Aleth Rothschild is an OBGYN who has worked in healthcare reform and women's movements for many years. Since 1997, she has focused much of her energy on understanding the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. She was born in 1948, a good year, same year as Israel became a country. And Sharon, is it Sharon? Sharon, Massachusetts?
Sharon,
Massachusetts, yeah. Moving to Brookline, Mass for her last year of high school. She became a part of a synagogue in the 1950s and 60s. Alice graduated from Bryn Mawr with a BA in psychology and attended Boston University School of Medicine. She did her medical internship in London Hospital in South Bronx and obstetrics and gynecology. Residency is Beth Israel Hospital in Boston. She was medical director of the Women's Community Health Center in Cambridge. And after completing her residency, she co-founded Urban Women and Child Health in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts, and worked in this nonprofit organization in physicians, midwives, and nurse practitioners for a while, for over 10 years. Alice currently lives with her husband, cabinet maker, in Brookline, and they have daughter, and she has children, and she's part of the, let me get this straight, the Boston Workmen's Circle Yiddish Chorus. And I only, I like, I highlight that because we don't have such things.
Let's put it this way. Her resume makes me wonder what I've been doing
with my life. There you go. So. All right. So, like I said, because we're going to talk about, what is a hot-button issue? We wanted to establish Aleth Rothschild's credibility as much as we possibly could because we have none of our own. So the good morning, Aleth. Let's talk about – I did look at your book, Condition Critical. Now you've written several books. Let me get down to that.
Broken Promises, Broken Dreams, yeah. Stories of Jewish and Palestinian Trauma and Resilience,
yep.
Published in 2007. And she has a documentary film, Voices Against the
Across the Divide.
Excuse me, Mike, can't read this morning.
And her other book, On the Brink, Israel and Palestine on the Eve of the 2014 Gaza Invasions, and today's book, Condition Critical. She just got back from the Middle East. She was there in 2017, which, as I recall, was last month. And we're going to talk a lot about that effect. But what I wanted to get up front here, one of the things that I noticed first about when I opened your book, and it's funny and it's not funny, it's just so appropriate for politics of today. One of your reviewers said, "How does a lie get created and sold as truth?" In Condition Critical, Aleth Rothschild grabs the truth behind the lies, writing with extraordinary moral clarity and a sharp eye for the injustices, absurdities, and cruel historical ironies that define Palestinian life on both sides of the Green Line. Let's talk about everything. Let's talk about your, let's start with your visit, I guess. What'd you see in 2017?
So I was in the region for 2.5 weeks in January, and I started out with a delegation from Grassroots International, which is a donor organization that helps communities who are working on issues of land and water. And it's a development agency that is trying to promote social justice. It's not just, you know, giving people seeds or tractors or something like that.
Right.
So we started out visiting the partner organizations that this group supports. And so we were visiting agricultural workers and farmers and groups that are organizing to fight the separation wall that is being built on the West Bank and taking up Palestinian land. And we were exploring the West Bank, and I was also visiting with medical students and young doctors that have done exchange program at Harvard Medical School. I was at Harvard, and we set up an exchange program between Al-Quds Medical School in Jerusalem and Harvard. So then I was going to visit these young doctors in their homes and meet their parents and all that kind of stuff, because I was one of the hosts for these students. And then we learned a lot about the struggles of farmers and people in communities who are affected by occupation. And the occupation of the West Bank is something that doesn't really get discussed enough in the media, as far as I can tell. So people don't understand what it's like to have your land taken away, to not have access to water that's in your own aquifer, but it's being used by an Israeli company and then sold back to you, not being able to get to work, not being able to get a permit, all those kinds of things that affect daily life. And then I went to Gaza for 4 days, and this was my third visit to Gaza. And I was very lucky to get a permit, since they're very hard to get.
Right.
And in Gaza, I was working with the Gaza Community Mental Health Program, which is the only major psychiatric facility in Gaza. So you have 2 million people with post-traumatic stress disorder and a group of psychiatrists and health workers trying to help the population. And I also focused on women's groups because I'm an obstetrician. So I worked with four different women's groups in Gaza doing health empowerment workshops and, workshops where women could talk about their lives and strategize how to make them better. I'm also involved in a program called We Are Not Numbers, which is a program started by a woman named Pam Bailey in the U.S. She's a writer. And so she's organized a group of students in Gaza who are English students. So they're majoring in English literature or, stuff like that. And basically they want to learn how to write good English. So they get mentored, attached to a mentor who's an English writer. So I met with the We Are Not Numbers group. I have mentored four of their students already. And we had a very in-depth discussion about what does it mean to be a writer? How do you do advocacy for your personal views of the world? How do you explain to the world what's going on? That kind of stuff. And then I went back to Israel and the West Bank, visited in Haifa and Jaffa, again visiting with activists who helped me to see sort of the other side of the story that doesn't get reported, and also to visit people that I've hosted in the U.S. So I spent a day in Benin, which is a town on the Green Line in the West Bank that is involved in a popular struggle against the wall. I've been there on Fridays during the popular struggle, but I'd never been there on a Wednesday when we could actually sit around and talk about life in Benin. So similar things like that. So it was an extraordinary trip.
So tell us about just that, the struggle, the Israeli-Palestinian thing, from what you said, which side is not getting reported?
Well, the side that I find that's not getting reported is the stories of the people that are affected by occupation and siege. I think we are very aware of how Jewish Israelis feel living in Israel, what their issues are, what their politics are. But very, very rarely do you actually hear what is it like to live in a village where a huge Jewish settlement is being built and gobbling up your land, and the soldiers come in to your village at night and arrest your children because they were throwing stones at a tank. And you don't really get to hear that life story.
And you're saying all this as an American Jewish woman.
Right. And I'm publicly Jewish there. you know, and I have really no trouble because the Palestinians that I work with make a real distinction between a Jewish person. They have nothing against Jewish people or the Jewish religion. What they are opposed to is Jewish Israelis coming and taking their land. That's right. A different category. And I actually spent a day in Ofer prison, which is where there's a huge amount of, just similar to the U.S., where a disproportionate number of African Americans are spending time in prison. So there's a huge amount of arrests of Palestinians as well as Palestinian children. There's some 7,000 arrests a year. 700 arrests a year, and about 40% of the Palestinian male population has been arrested, so there's a disproportionate arresting. And I wanted to see what happens in the prisons, and that's a whole other issue because people live under military rule, so it's a military court, which is a very different experience than a civil court. So there's all sorts of levels that most people in the U.S. are completely unaware of. And I think the voices of Gazans are very rarely heard. You hear about, you know, Hamas and Islamic Jihad, and you hear about, you know, some bomb landing in a field near Sidrot, and that's completely terrifying to the people in Sidrot. But you don't hear about what is life like when you only have electricity 3 hours a day, what is life like when your hospitals have been bombed, you know, and what is life like when 27 of your family members were killed in the last war and you're the head psychiatrist of the Gaza Community Mental Health Program. How do you get up in the morning? I mean, I find those stories really help me to understand the historical and political realities.
This, I think, is one of the important issues that I found in reading your blog. And could you give us the URL for your blog on air so people could visit? Because there's some great stories there.
Sure. So I have a website, which is alicerothchild.com, without an S, Alice Rothschild. And I've been blogging for about, I think, 7 years now. And so I post these blogs. And so my January trip, I'm up to day 20, I think. So every day I post a blog, and people are welcome to read them. And there's years of blogging, so there's a lot of stories. You can see how the situation evolves by reading these blogs. And my book, Condition Critical, Life and Death in Israel-Palestine, is a curated collection of blog essays and then analytic essays with it. So it's sort of the best blogs I have to offer you. But, you know, the blogs from January, you know, every day before I went to sleep, I just wrote a blog. And for me, it's sort of both therapy because I would be so upset or, you know, overwhelmed or unhappy with what I was seeing. And it helped me to put it down, describe exactly what I was seeing, report it to the listening public or reading public. And it's my way of trying to contribute to the conversation.
And so, I do want to say that the blogs are very personal and very powerful, and if you have an interest in this topic as a listener, go to Alice's blog page and or buy the book and read as many of these as you can. And as you say, even as a reader, the suffering and the pain becomes almost unbearable, and it's hard to take so much at once. On the other hand, I have a house guest. And you know, there's the big issue here, the issue that is been talked about for the last, 70 years. The Palestinians, at least reportedly, would like to see Israel wiped off the face of the earth, and the Israelis treat them in this manner that you've described so clearly in your books and documentary and everything. That so certainly the people on one side say, well, if they would just accept the Israelis, you know, in the region, then they would get humane treatment. Why isn't it that simple?
Well, I think, you know, history is always told by the victors. And the narrative that you described is a very popular narrative.
Yeah.
When I step back and I look at, you know, 100 years of history, and I read the new Israeli historians like Ilan Pappe and Benny Morris and a whole host of other Jewish Israelis who went into the archives of the Israeli government and actually looked at what happened, and as well as Palestinian historians, there's a whole other narrative that is not being discussed. So if you think about it, You know, Jews have suffered from anti-Semitism for centuries. This is a European phenomenon, culminated in the Holocaust. We all know this. And this is, you know, a historic catastrophe, the Holocaust. If you look at the Zionist movement back in the 1890s, it was very clear that this was part of a whole growing sense of nationalism that was happening in the world, and also a response to European anti-Semitism. But if you, you know, one of the things that's interesting is that when they had their first Zionist Congress with Herzl, he sent a group of rabbis to the Holy Land to check it out, because they were thinking of, should we have a state in Uganda? You know, where should we do it? And the rabbis telegraphed back, the bride is beautiful, but she's married to another man. So from the beginning, the early Zionists knew that this was not a land without a people and a people without a land. This was a land that had a whole population living in it. There were Christians, Muslims, and Jews. The Jews were the minority. But, you know, they thought that the Jews spoke Arabic and called themselves Palestinians. And so if you start looking at the actual history and reading, you know, Ben-Gurion's diaries and all of those kinds of things, it is really clear that the plan was to take the land and get rid of the indigenous population. And once you understand that, then it's understandable that the indigenous population might not like to be dispossessed or gotten rid of. I mean, this is true anywhere in the world. And so the fact that when the UN partition plan came about after, you know, the British had their whole colonial enterprise, and it's much more complicated, I'm just giving you the highlights, but when the UN partition plan came about, there is no reason why an indigenous population would say, sure, you can have half my country or my land. You know, people don't agree to that kind of thing. So it was set up in a way that was destined to be constant conflict, because the Jewish Zionists who came in were saying, my suffering and my history and my yearning takes precedence over yours. And the people who were going to lose out were not going to lose out without a fight. And so what's been going on since 48 is a continuation of that, where it's not like, you know, if you look at the writings of the Israeli leaders, you know, they were going to accept the partition plan and then take as much as they could take.
That's true.
You look at, you know, that's how they did it. And that's continuing. I mean, if you look at the settlement project from 67, there are now some 700,000 Jewish settlers living in East Jerusalem and the West Bank. This is a continuation of a process of taking land and trying to get rid of the Palestinians. So the fact that Palestinians are not happy with that should not come as a shock to anybody. We wouldn't be happy with it if it was us. No indigenous population would be happy with that. So, you know, I think it starts out like, if you want to have peace between people, you have to respect their narratives, their pain, their desires equally, and you have to make, you know, you can't have a dominant party dispossessing another party and then complain that the other party is fighting.
No, it's a natural.
It just doesn't work that way.
It's a natural. All over, when you get occupied, you resist. Let's talk for a minute about the politics, the U.S. politics. We got Obama going out, Trump coming in. I'm guessing part of the reason for the animosity between Netanyahu and Obama was Obama's support of the two-state solution, the Palestinian position, at least to a degree. What is the other guy? Do we know? Yeah, it's
so
tough.
First of all, I do want to say that everybody talks about all the animosity between Obama and Netanyahu, and I'm sure that they didn't like each other.
Yeah.
But Obama still gave Israel $3.8 billion a year for 10 years. So,
good point.
When push came to shove, the Israelis still got their money. They still got their military. They still got cover in the UN. You know, it really, I think it's an exaggeration to say that, you know, he threw them under the bus or whatever the expression is. If you look at actually what happened politically, you know, financially, militarily. You know, with our current president, first of all, it's hard to know what his policies are because he doesn't seem to have a real political framework that's coherent and consistent. It's sort of foreign policy by Twitter. But I'll give you my best guess.
Thank you.
Which is that given the advisors and the people he's choosing in his cabinet and for ambassadors and all that kind of stuff, and I just had a piece in Alternet about this, actually. I think he is very much giving permission for the Israeli right wing to go for it, to you know, I mean, Netanyahu has announced thousands and thousands of settlement building houses, and, you know, there's not going to be any pretense that anyone is thinking about peace or two-state solution or respect for Palestinian aspirations. I think that's out the window, and that's pretty disastrous if you're interested in any kind of long-term solution. So given his, first of all, his just ignorance of the situation, I mean, his, you know, chatter about moving the embassy, the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, I mean, legally he can do that, but no American president has chosen to do that because they knew that this would spark a huge crisis in the Arab world, a huge amount of hostility towards Israel. I mean, it's of no gain. And, you know, he seems to be pulling back now because people are whispering in his ear that might not be such a great idea. But I think, you know, he's not going to be good for the process of moving forward towards any kind of just peace at all.
We're talking to Alice. We're talking to Alice Rothschild on Democratic Perspective about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and all of her work, her humanitarian work as a doctor and her authorship of Condition Critical and her documentary as we're going, The Voices Across the Divide. But we would do want to mention that Democratic Perspective is supported by the El Portal, a wonderful little hotel over here, nestled in the on the banks of Oak Creek and next to a wonderful Talaki Paki, pet friendly in the heart of Sedona. It's a great little place that Steve Segner and his wife have got going for us here. A great place to have breakfast and just the cutest little hotel you've ever seen in your life. Bring that and all the money you ever had, and you can probably get a room.
I have a question that I'd like to get in about the, you know, when you visited the West Bank. Let's talk about the settlements for just a moment. Can you describe what's going on with the settlements? Everyone here hears the term settlements, and I think they don't have a true understanding of what that means.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are three large settlement blocks out of north, central, and south, and they consist of basically anywhere from a small town to a huge village. Like the settlement of Modein Elit, I think, has 60,000 people in it. I mean, these are big cities. And what's happened is that about 80% of the Jewish settlers in the West Bank are what are called economic settlers, and 20% are political, you know, motivated to grab every inch of land kind of settlers, much more religious, you know, ultra-Orthodox religious type folks. So you do have two kinds of settlers. But the thing that's happened is that the Israeli government has supported the settlement movement, and so they will, you know, the houses are cheap, there's excellent infrastructure, they build beautiful roads, you get electricity and water. So the settlements are supported by the Israeli government. And this is to the detriment of Israelis living in the state of Israel who, you know, complain of all the problems with the loss of social safety net and the huge military budget and all that stuff. So I hear Israelis saying we are held hostage by the settlement movement. But the government uses the settlers to grab more land. So you have what are called legal settlements, although all settlements are illegal under international law. And then you have these caravans, which are, you know, youth that, you know, hilltop youth, and they set up a caravan on the next hill and set up a little outpost, and then they have a big skirmish with the military. But ultimately, I mean, they just legalized illegal settlements, although, you know, again, I'm using their language. So people don't understand that these are huge cities, and they're sort of gradually worming their way across the West Bank and taking land. And if land is taken for Jewish settlement, then it's not available for a Palestinian state, should there be a Palestinian state. So what a lot of folks are saying now is that if there was once a possibility for a two-state solution, that has been destroyed by the settlement movement, because so much land has been taken. So many roads are now connected to so many settlements. There's so many military outposts to protect the settlement. You know, so what the Palestinians have left is basically a Swiss cheese kind of thing. And that's coupled with the fact that the Jordan Valley on the east coast is now a closed military zone. So the Palestinians have sort of a peace squeezed in between. And it's very destructive to Palestinian economy, to people being able to have access, movement, and, you know, all the things that people need to have a viable life.
Well, that's it. You hear, and my argument has always been the life of Palestinians in that region. I'm 90%. You hear things like 90% unemployment. You hear things like 40% domestic violence, families involved, and that's directly related to, as I believe you point out in your blog post, not having work is a terrible, terrible thing.
I mean, those numbers I don't think are correct, but there is a high level of unemployment, much more in Gaza than in the West Bank. And
right.
There are issues of domestic violence that we see from men that are humiliated at checkpoints, unable to find work, you know, and ultimately in any society, you know, women bear the brunt of this. I don't think those percentages are correct, though.
Living in Arizona, I was struck by some of the stories of the use of water and walls as political tools. Maybe you could talk about the water situation.
Yeah. The water situation? Okay, so major water aquifers in this region are located in the West Bank. And the settlements have been very strategically placed over a lot of the aquifers. And with the Oslo Accords, there were a number of things that were agreed upon or that were the Palestinians were pressured to take. And one of them was that the Israelis control the water. So the Israelis pump the water out of the aquifers. There's a big company called Nekarot. And then they sell the water that is below the villages of the Palestinians back to the Palestinians at high prices. They also allot water to Jews and Palestinians in the West Bank, and the Jewish settlers get a much higher allotment at a much lower cost. So, I mean, imagine being in a Palestinian village. You live with your extended family. You've been there for centuries. You are a university student. You know, you're doing your thing, and there's months when you have water, you know, one day every 2 weeks, every 3 weeks, you fill your water tanks on top of your roof and hope to make it to the next water delivery. And meanwhile, you can see a settlement on the next hill where they have green grass, watered gardens, a swimming pool, and they have much, much water than you do. So there's this tremendous distinction between who gets water at what price, right, at what volume, and when. And, you know, that's a problem.
But that's
I mean, the Israelis claim they're, you know, the big high-tech water nation, and they've turned the Negev into, you know, gardens and blah, blah, blah. But they use the water from the Palestinian West Bank to have water for settlers and in Israel.
Let's talk about your documentary and your book. Let's talk about the book first. Condition, what's the critical condition?
Condition critical.
But what,
yes.
What is the condition that is so critical?
So I'm using a sort of a physician metaphor that if the Middle East is a patient, the patient is in critical condition. And so the way that I try to highlight that is through a collection of curated blogs that are just reporting on what I have seen. So I'm just describing someone's life or someone's home or a clinic I went and worked in or, you know, whatever the blog is about. But it's very intimate and personal because I feel like so many people have so many push-button moments and can't hear what other people are saying. But I think we can all agree, you know, that women should have prenatal care, that no one should deliver at a checkpoint, that, you know, if a Jewish kid throws a stone, you know, maybe the police will call his mother and his mother will tell him not to do that. If a Palestinian kid throws a stone, if it's at a moving object, he can get, you know, 10, 20 years in prison. I mean, that there are some basic issues on a very personal, intimate level that will help people to see what's going on better. So the book is a collection of blogs curated, and then I have some analytic essays before, after, around to give you a framework in which to think about these things and to raise, you know, some very serious questions about how we look at this history and how we understand the politics. My film is a very different thing. It's interviews with Palestinian Americans who live here, or American citizens, and who are telling their family stories. So what I tried to do was to, again, tell the history of the region that no one knows, but through personal stories. So, you know, I don't talk about 48. I have some guy who was a little kid in 48 describe what happened to his family, you know. So it tells the whole history. And then I collected family photos, historical footage, footage from the UN, from the BBC, you know, all the places that you can find footage and photos, and wove it all together to give people a sense of what does this look like when you start listening to the voices of the people who aren't heard. And so it's a 55-minute film. There's a website that has a huge amount of resources on it, a study guide. It's designed for universities or community groups. And it's been a really amazing experience showing this film.
Let me characterize Alice. We're talking to Alice Rothschild here about Israeli-Palestinian conflicts, and I believe in her book and in her writings, she represents this extremely personal stories of Jews and Palestinians in the region, in the Middle East, and yet points out historically that the takeover of Palestinian homes and homeland was always there was always a well there was the two things a Jewish nationalist movement and as you say in your book from the 1880s and then of course the response to the European situation with Jews and the unspeakable treatment during the Holocaust and but does any of this does this when we have day after day after day of treatment of people that live in the region who originally and are trying to share the region with Israelis and as you can see from her stories and her blogs and her medical discussions that come out on the short end. It's just a difficult life, certainly on both sides, but there's one side on top here, and who has the keys to the kingdom, and not.
If I may, the
please,
you know, the issue is to me is in politics we're always, you know, kind of forced or pushed to take sides, and. And I think in this case, I don't know what the answer is politically. And Alice, you may have some suggestions with that. But the reality is that is the impact on people's lives and you know civil rights and human rights and it doesn't matter whether it's in Syria or whether it's in Gaza or the West Bank or wherever. There are people that are unnecessarily, in my view, suffering. And so I think what struck me about your book and about your blog is that these are the things that we need as a country, as a people to understand to help us better, you know, deal with the politics. Is that
right.
A fair assessment?
Right. I mean, I think that for me also as a Jewish American, knowing about anti-Semitism, knowing about, you know, the Jewish ghettos and all of the history in Europe, that to then have a country that was supposedly created to protect me and supposedly speaks in my name, but then is committing very similar things to what was done to us, you know, in terms of ghettoization, in terms of racism. It's the, you know, the abused becoming the abuser, that whole situation. That's a very tough nut to swallow. And so part of the healing that has to happen within the Jewish community is to recognize that's the reality and that the people that are supposedly the evil enemy you know, we only hear about when, you know, there's a suicide bombing, but you don't hear about the enormous number of peaceful people who are trying to get through the day, who are involved in human rights struggles, who are trying to protect their land and their children, and who don't actually view Jews as an enemy unless you're trying to take something from them. So I do see this as much more of a human rights struggle. And for me, the side that I take is the side of human rights. So it's not that I'm pro-Israel or pro-Palestine. It's that I'm pro-human rights. And I think if you can get to that place, then you can start crossing lines that usually don't get crossed. And it becomes a really interesting journey at that point. But you got to get out of the box, because the box we're in right now is completely dysfunctional. And, you know, I would not look to the U.S. administration or politicians in Israel or Palestine for any solutions, because I think it's clear that they have failed miserably. But it's also really important to remember the imbalance of power. I mean, it's not like the Palestinians have an army. You know, 99% of Palestinians have never touched a gun. And, you know, they're not being portrayed that way in the media. And it's part of the, you know, the discrimination against Muslims and the discrimination against Arabs. I mean, they get hit coming and going, and they also get hit by, you know, reactionary Arab regimes in the area that use them to stir up their population, and so the populations don't pay attention to how terrible things are in their own country. So Palestinians are actually fairly inspirational for me, because there's so many decent, good people doing incredible work around human rights and civil rights and psychological health and that kind of thing.
That's a great summary, I guess, that on the human level, on the personal level, on the human rights level, then that's when a lot of the politics should and fall away. And you have your organizations, once again, talking to Alice Rothschild, the Jewish Voices for Peace and the Jews for a Just Peace and the Health and Human Rights committees of those organizations are doing whatever they can to help these non-political, however political aggravated or caused issues, and that's the issues of just living day to day in a really traumatic situation. And
you know what, I'd also like to say that it's also not good for Jewish Israelis that if you get dehumanized enough to be able to, you know, beat up a kid in the middle of the night or, you know, act in the manner that a lot of Israeli soldiers act, it's dehumanizing for the soldier. You know, it's not good for people to be racist. And, you know, I mean, so I'm doing this work not because I don't like Israelis. I'm worried about everybody, you know. I think it's important to remember that in this conversation.
Good point.
It's a reality that almost everybody's a victim in these sorts of situations.
Those of us that are veterans saw this coming when Bush sent people into Afghanistan. I was as worried or more worried about the American service members as much as I was the Iraqis.
I mean, Jewish Israeli soldiers die more from suicide than they do from combat.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, it's the same issue with our soldiers. You know, I mean, we're all in this together, you know.
Yeah. Go ahead, John.
One thing we haven't really addressed is, I guess you mentioned it briefly, is the you have some blogs on the Gaza Community Mental Health Program, and I found the discussion about that in the blog posts fascinating. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Right. So this is a group of very extraordinary clinicians that founded a psychiatric facility that was founded by Dr. Iyad El-Sarraj, who's just a luminary psychiatrist. And what their basic tenet is that you can't have mental health without having human rights. So they work with, you know, individual patients. They also work on the society. They work in schools to help children have learn how to mediate their issues. They, you know, make campaigns around human rights issues. So they take the very broadest kind of look at how do you have healthy people. On the other hand, you know, in 6 years, there were three horrific assaults on Gaza. So the amount of trauma and post-traumatic stress disorder and depression in the Gaza Strip is pretty overwhelming. And these folks, you know, like I said, the executive director lost 27 members of his family in the last war. These folks, the clinicians themselves, have the same trauma as their patients, and yet they continue to get up in the morning and do their work. They've raised money. They're building a whole new facility that's really inspirational. They work with women around issues of gender violence. I mean, they're doing all sorts of extraordinary things, both, and also they're doing a lot of training because there's not enough people to do the work. So they have special training for mental health counseling, for treating post-traumatic stress disorder. And, you know, the work that they do is applicable to any refugee population that has been seriously traumatized. So I think that their work is very important in Gaza, but it's also applicable throughout the Arab world to huge numbers of other refugee populations that have fled or been bombed or lost houses, or, you know, the kinds of things that Gazans experience on a daily basis.
I want to quote from your book. Palestinians have often had dysfunctional, ineffective, and corrupt leadership, which has only contributed to the catastrophe. But this has never been a battle between equals. Today, Israel is one of the world's major military powers, has a mighty army and an extensive military industrial security complex. That, and I'm going to stop there, but the, that that the Palestinians just don't have. We're talking donkey carts as a major form of transportation. At one point, whether it's your blog or book, you talk about as you get away from, as you move in Gaza, as you move up the coast, you see the time just keeps going backwards to where and where people lived as they lived many, many hundreds of years ago. That the hand-to-mouth, the modern conveniences just aren't there, and schooling becomes and the tools to get out are also not there.
Right.
So whether that's...
And you know, even with that going on, there's a huge number of people in universities. Majority of university students are women. You know, they're... Right. I mean, when I'm talking to students who are studying English literature, I'm sort of blown away, but they have a 63% unemployment rate for the kids who graduate. Yeah. So, you know, it's like a very contradictory, you know, you may not have electricity and a functional kitchen, but your kid goes to the university. You know, it's a very interesting blend of first and third world because of the politics. Yeah,
the fine points of Shakespeare, which is great. I think that's a good thing in the long run. Have you got a solution here, Alice? What are we going to do?
Well, I think the first thing we need to do is to be educated. So I do encourage people to look beyond the headlines and the tweets and whatever else people use to get a quick hit on the news.
Let me interrupt. There's lots of information in Alice's world here between her books, her documentary, and her blog post. If you're looking for information, if you don't feel like you got, please get these stories. They will open your eyes.
And then, you know, there's a lot of work being done with organizations like Jewish Voice for Peace and the Israel campaign for Palestinian rights, and a lot of work in the Christian churches and in mosques, trying to have campaigns to pressure and change the Israeli government. And one of the most exciting campaigns that has come out of Palestine is the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanction movement, which is a whole other discussion. But I think when people get upset about the idea of boycotting, you know, if Palestinians are living under an oppressive regime and they react violently, then they're totally condemned. And now they're reacting nonviolently, and they're getting totally condemned. So you can't expect an oppressed people not to react. And I think we should applaud the Boycott, Divestment, Sanction movement because it's a form of nonviolent resistance. And so that's how I think there's going to be a change in the tipping point. But
Excellent.
We should know in the U.S., you know, many state governments are outlawing boycott as a form of anti-Semitism, which is a whole confusion between hating Jews for being Jews and a political movement that's been used by activists for
many
decades. So,
Alice, we're out of time. We're going to be cut off here in just a second. Please notice our Democrats of the Red Rock sponsors, and please find this podcast on VVID.org and other places on the web, VVID.org. Find the podcast of Democratic Perspective.
been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and our nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 a.m. news and our Saturday replay after the noon news right here on AM 780.